it is the springtime of my loving. The second season, I don't know her. You are the sunlight in my growing. So little home I felt before. It isn't hard to feel.
Welcome back to the A Bold Scientist Under the Shower. Here I am after the summer break, more energetic than always, because a great year is starting. And here today we have a great guest, as I said in the post on Facebook, the father of all guests. And we're gonna tell you in 1 second why is the father of all guests, for several reasons. One above all, and we're gonna tell you in 1 sec. For today, I was so today is a great first academic show. So I was thinking, just if you are listening to us, just send us, I don't know, questions. If you are curious, if you have questions to our guest, so. On my so you can write me on WhatsApp for people who knows me, or my Facebook, or whatever, wherever you want. I will try to read your questions. So now, First of all, or actually second of all, after the introduction, we were introduced by a great song by Led Zeppelin, The Rain Song. And actually rediscovered this song from a very nice movie I watched last time. I don't know if you're interested, but I'm gonna tell you anyway. Almost Famous, about the Stillwater, a great band in the 70s. I just discovered thanks to this movie. So I suggest you to watch it just for the music, not really for the movie. Anyway. We are here with our guest. It's your second time, Federico De Martino. How are you doing? Hi.
I am very good, Francesco. Thanks a lot for having me for a second time, which...
You are the only one who came twice.
Yes, but last time we said that maybe this was going to become a once in a time, but a more regular appointment to talk about topics that have to do with the brain and neuroscience in general, which is of course a topic that we both love. So it's a very interesting and a wonderful opportunity. Thanks a lot.
Absolutely. So Federico De Martino, associate professor at Maastricht University. And so it's really a great pleasure to have you here. Actually, before starting the show, we were also thinking, we were brainstorming about probably the next show about taking some big paper, some hot topic in neuroscience and discuss it here without this filtering of journalists that probably most of the time don't know anything about the neuroscience. Sometimes they are good interpreter of the result, but sometimes are a bit fuzzy. So probably it's better if we kind of try to destructure the paper and try to understand whether those results are, well controlled or a good result, or they mean something, or they be replicated, something that is very important in science in general, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that scientists should be definitely more engaged, like you are, in making our work more accessible to the public. It's a responsibility that we all bear, the ones of us that do this job. Otherwise, sometimes we are so separate from the everyday life, and people tend to not trust what we do. And it seems that often this job is mandated to who reads and interprets our work. And of course, the sensational representation is the one that is so popular, which may not be the right interpretation. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. It is also important for us from a perspective of let's say giving back. We should not forget that our work is financed and funded through public money. So we always have to
money.
Well, you know, of course, it would be nice that it would be more. Science in the end needs to move forward. Then it's something that we all benefit in the short or in the long term. And our responsibility is to explain how does this happen and how do society benefit from it. It's something that scientists need to learn. Is not all scientists are trained for it. Few are, I would say. Also, some scientists are not necessarily willing to, because they think it's maybe sometimes can be thought as a loss of time, which is of course not the right way. I think that this show, as many other opportunities are there out, like social media, to make our work more accessible to people is super important. And there are also many scientists that make the full transition, mm-hmm. and they become great communicators. This is a gift, of course, and one that I think you have. So the one of being able to reach out and to be able to explain thoughts, things that are complicated in a simple way. As much as possible, I'm happy to try and help
absolutely
in this process.
You were very useful, clear last time, so I'm sure you're going to be this time as well. But it's true that it's a very good, it's very true that sometimes scientists and science is just talk to each other. So they are kind of closed. while probably would be very important also for this money issue. I mean, probably there is not so much money because people are just not interested. Probably if we would be more open, they would start a positive cycle where people would be more interested. So probably would ask ideally for more. Probably, I don't know, they will start up this
absolutely
this positive cycle of having.
I think overall is a good thing to be able to explain our work in a simpler way. It's important to try to make things more accessible. This is at the end we are providing knowledge that should be accessible to everybody. So some scientists have a gift of writing in an accessible way. There are many examples in many, many fields, in physics or in mathematics, mm-hmm. Or in neuroscience, of scientists that are able to write popular books that can be read by the masses. And I think that this is an absolute gift that maybe comes with time. And for some people, it's also maybe inbuilt. Communication is definitely something that needs to be trained. I do agree that is something we should be engaged more in our job.
Absolutely. Let's start then to do our job, as you call it. So today, while brainstorming, we actually thought that it was needed probably due to this also great company, huge company like Google or Facebook engaging in this computational, so-called computational neuroscience. So probably was important for us to explain the difference between what is called computational neuroscience more for the public audience, the artificial intelligence with what we do, which is neuroscience. Actually, we do both, actually. But that's, I think, what is probably needed to tackle the link between the two. So between the artificial intelligence, computational neuroscience, and neuroscience. So first of all, what is neuroscience? What is the cognitive neuroscience?
Well, what we do, or where at least where we spend a lot of our time, is to study the biological processes that are at the basis of our perception. So how we, for example, see things or hear things, our cognition, so how we think about things, and also our actions, and ultimately what are the processes that govern our behavior. So how, for example, we decide to move our hands in a specific way to grab, for example, a bottle, or to decide to respond to a certain things and not another. And these are all processes that are important because we don't really know a lot of this, of how this happens in the brain. And cognitive neuroscience really deals with the biological underpinnings of this. So we study the human brain while we are performing these things, and we try to measure the brain with several techniques in order to understand what the units, the neurons that are the units in our brain that are responsible for all these processes, interact with each other and result in this behavior. And of course, we need to observe the brain through many, many different techniques. It's not sufficient to use just one, because all of these techniques have different benefits. They have different advantages and different disadvantages.
So, for instance, can you describe some of them? Like, well, I guess that
the most popular, or the one that has been used for very long, is electroencephalography. Which is a method that measures electrical activity. So we measure tiny currents that can be measured on top of the scalp. So you measure, you wear a cap that looks more or less like a swimming cap that you wear when you go to the swimming pool. On this cap, there are some tiny little electrodes that don't hurt you at all. And they measure little electrical currents that result from brain activity and can be measured outside of the scalp. So it's a totally non-invasive way of measuring brain activity. It has a great advantage of being very precise temporally. So it has a we can measure the activity of the brain in a very fine-grained temporal manner. So we can follow the activity of the brain in milliseconds time resolution. An alternative to this is magnetoencephalography, which is spatially more precise.
Because because you made this difference, because EEG is not so spatially precise.
Well, it's corrupted by the fact that the electrical activity of the brain needs to travel from the brain to the outside of our head, so to the scalp, and of course in between there is, for example, our skull, which is made of bone, and the skull being not conductive, so not conducting electricity very well, makes it less precise. And of course,
so we don't know exactly where this signal that we measure on the electrodes comes from.
We can make a guess, and this guess is maybe centimeters.
Okay.
A centimeters guess, in the sense of maybe we are a couple of centimeters off from where this activity really comes from. So we also are biased. We measured only certain neurons and not others, which of course can be a problem.
But we know more or less whether a processing comes before or after another one.
Yes, exactly. So this is the great advantage of these electrical methods, as well as the magnetic methods like magnetoencephalography, which is more... it's more complicated. It's not as portable as the EEG. EEG can be done even while you are driving a car.
Oh,
so
really?
You could wear a cap, and somebody could just measure activity while you're driving a car. Magnetoencephalography requires that you go into a room that is a specific room and has to be built in a particular way, and measures, instead of the electrical activity of the neurons, it measures the magnetic activity that is associated with this electric activity. So every current has an associated magnetic field associated with it. So it has somewhat, the neurons are little magnets when they are working, and they create a magnetic field, and this magnetic field can be detected. And in this case, it's more precise because the magnetic field is less corrupted by the skull than the electric field. So it travels through the skull in a better way. And in this way, our measure becomes more precise on the location. And then there are other techniques like the one that...
And I can tell you a little secret. And because Federico is very fond of this technique, as much as in his WhatsApp picture, he has this huge magnetic encephalography cap, isn't it, Federico?
Well,
where was that?
Well, it's not really a magnetic encephalography. I am very fond of fMRI, and my Twitter picture and Facebook picture is me inside a coil, so an antenna. I put my head inside a plastic thing that measures not the magnetic activity associated with
it. Oh, was that a magneto?
No, it's actually a piece of that is necessary for measuring functional magnetics, magnetic resonance imaging, which is instead a third technique that allows us to measure the blood as it travels to the locations that are active. So neurons that are performing a certain task or that they are doing something, they require, of course, energy. And energy in our brain comes through the blood, through oxygen for energy to be produced, we require oxygen. Like for your muscles, you require oxygen. Otherwise, you go in the so-called anabolic processing. So we need oxygen for metabolism. And this oxygen is delivered through the bloodstream. And we can measure this blood coming and going away from regions. And we use a technique that is called functional magnetic resonance imaging, which is newer, much newer compared to the others. So it's
just for the public audience, is this blood flow related to the electrical activity?
Yes,
because that's what we need, kind of.
Of course, yes, it is. Actually, there are many old, very old accounts of the fact that this is the case. Very first accounts have to do with people that had very thin skulls and putting a stethoscope, which is the thing that you measure the heartbeat with, on the skull of these people with very thin skulls and hearing the surge of blood when stimuli or when pictures were presented in front of the eyes of the persons. Now, instead of imagining that instead of using a stethoscope, we're now using a very big machine that allows us to measure this not only in people that have very thin skulls, but in everybody. Of course, again, this is not portable. You need to come to a specific place where we have these machines. Almost every hospital has one nowadays. So
we are the best. We have the best. Come on.
We have a good one.
We have a very good one.
And this allows us to get very, very good measures that are very precise spatially. So now these measures have
Much better than EEG.
They are much better in the spatial sense. So we are more precise. We are now in the millimeter range.
Oh,
so
wow.
We can be precise at the millimeter level. But temporarily, we unfortunately have to deal with the fact that the blood comes slowly compared to the electrical activity. So while we process a phase in hundreds of milliseconds, it may take seconds for the blood for measuring the response of the blood to the presentation of the stimulus.
So it's related in terms of electrical activity, but doesn't have the same temporal dynamic.
Absolutely not. So we measure a summary of what happens in maybe seconds of time. So our experiments need to be modified in order to be able to run these experiments. But it's important that we have multiple tools, and this is really what makes cognitive neuroscience attractive, that we can study the brain using a variety of tools, not just one. We can also interact with the brain, so we can also interfere with brain processing using other techniques where we interrupt or at least try to make some parts of the brain not work for a while.
What this technique that you are telling me now, I guess that it might be the transcranial magnetic
stimulation.
Why would I need to interrupt or interfere on the brain? What is the use?
The main argument is that we observe what the brain does in response to it. So we present a face and we see what the brain does. We present a house, we see a picture of a house and we see what the brain does. Or we hear a voice and we see what the brain does. Or we hear a dog and we see what the brain does. And there is an old saying that says that correlation is not causation. That means we observe the correlation between the presentation of a stimulus and what the brain is doing. And sometimes we tend to interpret this as saying if we see a brain area that always activates when we present as a stimulus, we say this brain area is responsible for processing. So it's the one that processes the stimulus. Well, you know, this is a somewhat classical fallacy. It's not necessarily the case. To be sure, or to at least gain a certain level of certainty over this, the important thing would be to see what happens if these neurons were not active. Would we still be able to do the same thing or to see the same thing or to hear the same thing? So in this way, without having to go to people that maybe don't have a certain or in which in whom these areas don't not work very well, we need to somewhat do it in a way that is harmless, that can be done.
Some sort of virtual
knocking out. So you give like a big punch to the neurons and you let them be a bit, you know, they don't work that well for a while. And then you observe what the brain is doing when these neurons are not working.
In order
very well.
To see whether those neurons are necessary to perform that.
Necessary to of course. This is in the end
the benefit of
a nice proof of what we want to do. And so this variety of methods and their combinations help us understand at the end our behavior. which is, of course, the holy grail of cognitive neuroscience, because we don't really know how the brain is actually responsible for the behavior that we have. So we, as I said the other time, we do things every day that to us seem so easy, like we can see the difference between a certain a face or another face, or we recognize the same face, your face, whether I see it from an angle or a different angle.
Yeah,
or,
but now you are almost I can say when you ruin
spoiling
the second part of the show that we're gonna talk about after the next song, which is Whisper from Malea. It's actually a singer that I discovered this summer in Basilicata, so the meaning of this song is because we like to whisper science in your ear.
I know the real me in every whisper. I know the real me in every whisper. I know me in every whisper. I know me. It's every desiderio informi, perché l'affanno che dal tempo ti distrae da tutto ciò che vuoi tu. E noi non, quella ruga che in più non è il segno che perdi, ma è quello che acquisti, lo sai, ad ogni sospiro che fai. Conosci ciò che senti, forse un giorno arriva Black Hole Sun. I'm waiting for the Black Hole Sun. I'm waiting for the Black Hole Sun. Ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong. Attesa non del tempo di aspettare ciò che cerchi. Che sai in realtà, forse non lo capirai mai, ciò che vuoi non lo sai, ricerca di bellezza incessanti, anime libranti che sono come fiamme accese in un oceano spento, e non troverò più scusa per fermarmi.
Tada, 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 tada
energia questa Alea! What energy is this Alea? Grande, grande, grande! Great artist, actually, I didn't even remember this song. Wow. Plus, we have a great system here in the boat of the radio boat. So, yeah, we're getting exciting. So exciting as the news that Federico wants to tell us about a great step in his life, which is related to why I call him the father of all guests. So why did you call you like that, Federico? What happened?
This is the last trick question that I told you not to ask me.
That's why I'm asking you.
But I have to then say that this year has been probably the most important year, or at least a wonderful year in my life. And the thing is that I became a father in June of Nicolò, and he's listening to me at this moment while I'm talking, and probably not understanding anything yet because he's 3 months old. But of course, it's a wonderful joy, and everything else disappears when this happens, and
oh, wow.
My life has gained new meaning. But thank you for associating this, and
absolutely
not so much thank you for asking this question.
He's getting emotional. So now let's go back, because we have we're already at the half. The second half of the show. So I was saying at the beginning that we also wanted to talk and to kind of let the general audience, our public, understand what is the difference between what you perfectly explain and all the methods and technique that make the what we call cognitive neuroscience, and what is the difference with what is a bit more mysterious for the general audience as the computational neuroscience? What is computational neuroscience? What is artificial intelligence?
I think these are two different things. One is artificial intelligence, and the other one is computational neuroscience. So I would say let's start with artificial intelligence. The same problems that we were talking about before. So how humans perform certain tasks. How do we see things and recognize faces? How do we recognize voices? Or how do we drive a car, for example? And they are, of course, of much interest to people that develop models of artificial intelligence in order to solve the same problems or to have computers solve the same problems. For example, self-driving cars, right? So we would all like, I would have liked that instead of driving myself off the way to Amsterdam from Maastricht, I could have just simply said I need to go to Amsterdam to the studio of Radio Salto, and then just input this thing in my car and then arrive here, while, for example, maybe I could have worked on something while the car was driving here. And these things are available nowadays, so there are solutions for these problems, and they are solved by computer algorithms or models that in some cases, not in all of them, but in many, many, many cases, are developed starting from an idea of how the brain also solves the same problem. Because of course our idea is the one of reproducing or replicating or replacing human behavior with artificial behavior.
Because, so, for instance, I can imagine that the way the car sees obstacle or sees the road might be designed like our visual system.
The way the car drives on its own might be designed how a perfect driver would drive. With we may argue whether the humans are a good or a bad example for that. But in general, of course, these are human abilities that we want to replace. For some cases, they can be necessary. So, for example, it would be interesting to understand how to replace functions that we lose. Just as an example, if we lose the ability to speak, we would be able to, we would be like to give back the ability to people to communicate, or the ability to move an arm. We would like to give them robotic arms that move in the same way, that allow them to grasp bottles in the same way. So there is, of course, this exchange that is necessary. It starts from the necessity of, or maybe it started from the necessity of replacing functions, but in some cases it's also just the one of performing or doing or having similar or solving similar problems in an automatic way. I use a lot Google Translate, for example, translating text from one language to another. It's very simple. It allows me to, for example, translate from languages I don't know to a language I know. Imagine this: one day we would be able to listen to people talking to languages we don't know and being automatically translated to us. Driving a car is another good example where this does not necessarily have to be done for people that cannot drive, but also it can be useful for people that can drive. So there are a lot of problems that are useful to be looked at or that want to be looked at from a simply computational point of view, solving the same problem from artificial agents that are doing the same thing as we do. And this as we do is the important, I think, the important link here, because as we do can be the one that can be the aim of approaching our performance. So we would like the car to drive as well as we do. It doesn't, for some people, it may not matter if the processes that are used are exactly the same that we use in order to drive the car. So maybe the system that solves the problem of seeing obstacles doesn't have to be the same as we do.
Perfect. That's very clear. But if, on the other hand, we would like to link the computation, we would like to use the computational neuroscience to understand our brain works, how can we link the two?
Exactly. So if we want instead to solve the problem of understanding exactly how we solve this problem, so if we want to use the advances in artificial intelligence to understand how the brain works, then we are entering this field of computational neuroscience, which is a field that tries to link the two sides. One side is cognitive neuroscience and neuroscience in general, which has to do with measuring the brain and looking at the brain while we are doing things, and the side of artificial intelligence and modeling and computer science that is only sometimes busy with trying to solve the same problems, but not necessarily worrying about the brain. And computational neuroscience mixes the two, tries to link the two as much as possible. There are many ways we can do this. And one of the ways, or one kind of straightforward way, is to have models and the brain do the same thing and then look at whether they are doing it in the same way.
So what do you mean exactly for model? So probably the general audience, for instance, let's take the visual system. So how can a model of the visual system can be built?
So today there are many models of how, for example, there are many models of the visual system, and there are many models that are built. One simple example is there are many models that are built to recognize different classes of visual stimuli. This problem is called categorization. So there are models that can tell you whether a picture is a face or, for example, a house. And there are even more complicated models that can find faces in different parts of a certain picture. So they can recognize where the faces are. When you take your iPhone and you have to take a picture, there is, for example, a little algorithm that draws the squares around the faces, that puts in focus the different faces. How is this happening? How is this possible that the phone knows where are the faces in this picture that you are moving at the moment because you move your phone around? So this thing that is in your phone is a computer algorithm. So it's a series of operations that are performed often simply one after the other, so in a sequential fashion, such that you go from the input, the picture, to, for example, where the faces are in this picture, or, for example, where the houses are on this picture, or both. And And there are many different models that can solve the same problem. So there are many different ways you can solve this problem from a simple computational point of view. So if you are interested only in solving this problem and not understanding whether this is the way the brain does it, you could design an algorithm yourself. And what computational neuroscience is interested in is any of these possible ways of solving this problem is similar to how the brain does the same thing. And this is what we really maybe are interested in from a neuroscience perspective, to take inspiration from the advances that artificial intelligences make, to understand whether these advances can make us understand how the brain works better, without forgetting also that these advances have stemmed from very original ideas about brain function. So many of these algorithms start from the idea that to recognize objects in a picture, you need a series of stages. And this is a classical neuroscience finding.
So like a first stage,
we, for example, have the eye, of course, and then the eye has different properties. The information is then transmitted to the brain, where first we have the analysis of orientations, of color, and then of the connections of lines into edges, into corners. Finally, you arrive to shapes like triangles, like ovals, and maybe you come to the idea that a certain shape is actually a face and not an egg, because they may bear some resemblance, but they are not the same thing to us. But also, we also have an idea of where the face is in our visual scene. So you know the face is in the top right or in the bottom left, and other parts of the brain are busy with this. And we know these things from neuroscience, and this information has informed people that are busy with developing artificial intelligence on how to build these computer algorithms. Sometimes these solutions have departed from neuroscience. So they have moved so far and they have done so well, maybe not taking in consideration what their actual possibilities of the brain are. So the advantages are from both sides. From one side, we can learn if anything that artificial intelligence has found is relevant to us. But on the other side, if we want to build an artificial intelligence that is as close as to the human brain as possible, then it's important to inform people that are developing these computer algorithms of which are the operations that are plausible in the brain.
So because sometimes the recognition of a face, or I don't know, the recognition of a sound in a noisy environment is not performed so well by an artificial intelligence or by a computer algorithm, because probably doesn't take into account discovery in neuroscience that we know by now are pretty much
absolutely. I would say that is not. There is one thing that is to bring forward. So this computer algorithm, these things that are living in our phones or in our computers all the time, they may not perform well all the time. So we know that they are not perfect, and we also know that humans are not perfect. But we know that there is a difference between human behavior. Still, is maybe sometimes better, not always. Sometimes computer behavior outperforms the human. But let's talk about the cases in which maybe we know that there is still a difference. Those are the ones that you are talking about. Maybe there is something we can provide to help reach human behavior, so to help these computer algorithms perform even better. But the other question that is important is also the one whether there are problems that are solved nowadays to a very well or to a very good performance, almost the one of humans. Are these problems solved the same way? So are we doing exactly those computations? Are we doing those things as they are implemented in these algorithms? This is also an important question, because I think that's the aim of computational neuroscience. The aim of computational neuroscience is the one of informing not only what comes next, but also of pruning what is already there, or at least modifying what is already there in order to be adhering to what we know the brain does. And thus, by in this way, moving step by step, not only checking what has already been done, but also moving forward to what needs to be done.
So the important thing is basically the communication back and forth between the two.
Yes.
So try to refine models that would fit the best
And also to help or to develop a way for people from the two sides of the fence to talk to each other. Sometimes
exactly.
This is difficult. We don't really know all the technical things that are behind all these very complicated algorithms. At the same time, we need to be able to communicate better what are the things that we think are absolutely necessary. So it's a very challenging field, but a field that is seeing a lot of development with the new conferences, for example, starting from people that we know. There is one coming up this week in Berlin, very interesting, where people from both fields come together to talk and to communicate and to really have an exchange of ideas. And that's the real interesting thing.
Thank you very much, Federico, for this connection and linking the computational neuroscience side with the cognitive neuroscience. So let's take another break with Bruno Risas, and then we're gonna probably talk about an unusual view on how the brain works, which is probably not yet, or probably is just the state of art of what computational neuroscience is implementing. So I leave you with the Costume da Torero from Bruno Risas, another artist that I saw in the same festival in Basilicata. So I wanted to just share what was my summer in terms of view music. Bruno Risas with Il Costume da Torero.
Quello che mi passa per la testa sembra avere senso quando penso che la vita forse un senso non ce l'ha. Certo non è bello quando guardo il mio castello in aria e penso che un castello così bello sulla terra non ci sta. La mia età non è questa, è almeno la metà. Passami il mantello nero, la mia spada da torero, oggi salvo il mondo intero con un gioco di magia. Non sarò mai abbastanza cinico da smettere di credere che il mondo possa essere migliore di così. Che mi serve adesso ritrovarmi con me stesso, anche se spesso con me stesso ritrovarmi non mi va. Certo non si può nemmeno stare tutto il giorno a disegnare una casetta con il sole quando il sole se ne va. La realtà è una merda ma non finisce qua. Passami il mantello nero, il costume da torero, salvo il mondo intero con un pugno di poesie. Non sarò mai abbastanza cinico da smettere di credere che il mondo possa essere migliore di com'è.
Non sarò mai abbastanza stupido. La, 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 la. And this was Bruno Risas with Il Costume da Torero. Great song. Thank you very much, Brunori. And so we just we are the last 5 minutes, but what I really wanted to talk about in terms of modeling of how the brain works and how the brain really works, so in this context I really want to talk about so what indeed neuroscience can share with the computational neuroscience in terms of new ways compared to years before on how the brain might work, not only in a bottom-up sense like you described before, to recognize a face, meaning before the processing the orientation, then considering each element and then taking all the elements together and then forming a face. But is there another way, another theory on how the brain works? Or can we add to this bottom-up way another way of seeing the brain processing?
Absolutely. I think that the best way to look at this is just looking at the fact that we perceive things in context. And what I mean is that when, for example, we are listening to something, we listen to this thing in relationship to what has happened before, what we know already. For example, you may be surprised, but when you are listening to people's voices through the telephone, for example, the telephone or the radio, they distort our voice quite a lot compared to when you are listening face to face. But you still recognize a person that you know. So you know this person, and this influences your perception. At the same time, maybe you have seen several pictures of a certain thing coming in a row, and then you expect something to happen next. A classical example for us in how this works is we play tennis, right? So when you are playing tennis, you cannot simply react to the ball that comes to you when the ball is close to you. Otherwise, this is too late. You will not hit the ball. You need to prepare in advance. You have to somewhat form an idea of where the ball is going to end with respect to your position and with respect to what you know, how the person is hitting the ball normally, how the sound of the ball, how the ball sounds when the person hits the ball, what's the trajectory that the ball takes when this person hits the ball at the beginning. You form a possible place where the ball is gonna end, and you move towards.
So knowing probably also the other player,
of course, right? Studying the other player, understanding how the other player plays, and this all informs us how we have to do some things. And there are also more simple examples that can be made. That for example, if you hear many times the same sounds in a row, you are going to just expect that the sound happens again. You're also, for example, expecting that after the knocks of a door, there is going to be a hello or a hi. In a certain way, you form expectations based on what's happening, which context you are in. And of course, this means that we generate an idea of what may happen next. It's not just a simple processing of the current stimulus. It's the current stimulus tells us something of the stimulus that would come next. And then somehow our brain has to combine these two things and process these two things. And this is, as you said, it's not just in the end anymore a simple approach that can go from edges to the face, but has to come back, has to somewhat inform the early stages of what we expect is going to happen. It's also true.
So in order to be more efficient in what we... In order to escape faster from a lion,
more
probably
than
evolutively
being
speaking.
More efficient, I think, in order to... because efficiency has to do with energy demands, I'm not so sure that this is more or less demanding, but it may be just a better way to solve the same problem. And at the end of the day, it is true that we, for example, perceive the same thing in a different way or in the same way, depending. So we for example, are very good in perceiving the same voice under different contexts. So this combination of information, this predicting power of what comes next. As I think something that is happening now that is absolutely very intriguing.
Thank you very much. I'm sure we're going to talk about that next show about what is called predictive coding in more general sense, isn't it? Can I define it like that?
Yes, there are several names for this theory, but this is one of them. Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much a lot, Federico De Martino. We're going to have you, I'm sure, very soon here on this show. So I thank you, Radio Onda Italiana, to have us, to add us here. See you next month and bye-bye with Sorgentone. Pete 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 p